Okay, sorry. Last week, we started reading through the book of Job, reading some selected passages, and we saw the first set of exchanges between Job and his three friends. And we read through them, and we began to see how wildly Job was reacting to his circumstances at the time. Basically, Job had been challenged, or God had been challenged, and Job had been afflicted by God through Satan. In an extraordinary way, he had lost everything by this point. He'd lost his health. He'd lost his property, much of his property. He still had property. But he also now is being pressed by his friends because of their beliefs in the doctrine of retribution. We talked about that last week, where God is supposedly one for one in this life. You sin, you draw God's wrath. You're righteous, you draw God's blessing, one for one in this life. And his friends believe that, and I think to a certain extent Job probably believed it as well before this happened to him. Well, Job is put into a terrible situation, a terrible tension, because his life, he knows himself to be a godly man, and we know him to be a godly man because God says he's a godly man. Not only is he a godly man, he's the most godly man. He's not just some run-of-the-mill guy like me. He's really a godly, truly man, the most godly man in the whole region, maybe in the whole world at the time. So, based on that, Job is put into a terrible tension. He knows that this is coming from God's hand. He knows that he doesn't deserve it in the sense of a retribution sense. He hasn't done anything to cause God to be angry with him. But he cannot tell the difference between what's happening to him and what he believes and what his friends believe should happen to the wicked. There's no outside way to tell it because God is, for all appearances and purposes, angry with Job. He's lit into Job and tearing him apart. And so we saw Job responding to that in the cycle of the first three speeches. And when we left him last time, he was begging to die. Essentially, this tension was killing him. I think it's worthwhile pointing out that this tension that I'm talking about, Job was not concerned about the fact that he had lost everything. He had already passed that test. Just the fact that he had lost his possessions, he didn't concern himself with his possessions. He didn't concern himself with his health. He didn't concern himself with all the things that had happened to him. He made clear confessions in the first and second chapters to buttress the fact that he was a godly man. Those were not the things that were bothering him. The thing that was bothering him was the fact that God was after him. His friend, his beloved, was after him for no apparent reason. And so we saw that he was in distress, mental, emotional distress, and that distress spewed out into speech that was rash in some places, understandably rash in some places. And that's what we read last week. I wanted to, every now and then I'm going to come across, there's a lot of stuff that's been written on Job that's just really wonderful. Beautiful language, and here's a guy whose quote about Job I thought was excellent. And it's Adam Clark. He had a commentary that was written back in the early 1800s. And his quote on the beginning of Job I thought was interesting and useful. And from time to time I'll bring these in and let you hear them. It doesn't really directly relate to what we're talking about today, but it's about the book in general. "This is the most singular book in the whole of sacred code. Though written by the same inspiration and in reference to the same end, the salvation of men, it is so different from every other book of the Bible that it seems to possess nothing in common with them. For the language in its construction is dissimilar from that in the law, the prophets, and the historical books. Except the first two chapters and the last 10 verses, which are merely prose, all the rest of the book is poetic and is everywhere reducible to the hemistic form in which all the other poetic books are written. It is therefore properly called a poem, but whether it belongs to the dramatic or epic series has not been deduced or decided by learned men." And then here's a little piece I thought was beautiful. "Genuine poetry is like a mountain flood. It pours down resistless, bursts all bonds, scoops out its own channel, carries woods and rocks before it, and spreads itself abroad, both deep and wide over all the plain. Such indeed is the poetry which the reader will meet with in this singular and astonishing book. I thought it was a free description. So, at any rate, we're going to now continue in this introductory phase. And again, I'm going to read a lot of scripture to you today. I'm going to skip now, at the end of the class today, I'm going to skip over to the last cycle of speeches. And I'm going to read to you Eliphaz's speech and then Job's response to him. But before we go there, I can't skip over chapter 19, because I think 19 is a pivotal chapter in the book. This is in the middle of the second series of speeches. This is where Job has been driven, I think, finally to his lowest. He is at the lowest point in terms of his understanding of what's going on. He's at his lowest point based on the fact that his friends are just unrelenting. They get worse after this, but in his view, they are misunderstanding him, and he's beginning to get angry with them. He's already been, we saw last week in his response to Bildad, he was already getting angry with them. And now it's getting worse because they won't let up on him. Well, so finally we come to chapter 19, where Job goes to his lowest point, but then Job wins in chapter 19. This is where Job triumphs. And Job proves himself to be a godly man in this passage of Scripture. So let me read it to you, and then we'll talk just a little bit more about it. Then Job answered and said, and of course we're jumping in the middle here, "How long will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have reproached me. You are not ashamed that you have wronged me. And if indeed I have erred, my error remains with me. If indeed you exalt yourselves against me and plead my disgrace against me, know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. If I cry out concerning wrong, I am not heard. If I cry aloud, there is no justice. He has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my paths. He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. My hope he has uprooted like a tree. He has also kindled his wrath against me, and he counts me as one of his enemies. His troops come together and build up their road against me. They encamp all around my tent. He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my close friends have forgotten me. Those who dwell in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger, and I am an alien in their sight. I call my servant, but he gives no answer. I beg him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am repulsive to the children of my own body. Even young children despise me. I arise, and they speak against me. All my close friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. My bone clings to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another. How my heart yearns within me. If you should say, how shall we persecute him, since the root of the matter is found in me? Be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment." You can see in here, Job's kind of reaching the end here. He's really, he doesn't understand what's happening to him. He doesn't understand why God is treating him as an enemy. He has every right to think that God's treating him as an enemy as far as visible circumstances. He knows that God is not treating him as we read in the chapter in Proverbs, where it says, if you do right, in Proverbs 3, I believe, if you do right, God's going to prosper you. That certainly had been Job's life up to this point. And Job hadn't changed at all, but suddenly God had changed and come after Job. And so here we are at the lowest point. He's pitiful. He's begging for his friends to have mercy on him, have compassion for him. And since we're not exegeting this passage, and when we do exegete it, we'll spend a lot more time on it. But we'll talk about some of the obligations that you have if you come upon a brother, even a stranger. If you come upon a stranger in a terrible situation, you should have compassion. But this is not a stranger. This is a godly man that they knew and loved, and they could not find it in their heart to have compassion for him. And he's pitiful. He's begging for this compassion. And he knows that even though he can't get compassion from his friends, even though everything that he knows has been turned upside down, even though God has savagely attacked him, and he had, he still hears his faith. He still, his faith rings out in these last passages, those last few verses here, starting in verse 25. For I know that my Redeemer lives. Now, after this, for I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. Those passages are difficult to translate. And there are a lot of differing views on the next verses, how and what relationship this passage of text has to do with the resurrection. And I'm not going to talk about it here today. When we get to it, we'll talk about it at length. But I want you to know this, not as clear-cut. This is a difficult passage to understand. What you're seeing here in the English text, there are a lot of words filled in. If your text has italicized words, you probably see a lot of italicized words. There are a lot of words that are filled in here. But the fact remains that Job makes a confession of faith at the depths of his despair. We saw kind of a precursor to this in chapter 16, verse 19, where Job says, "Surely even now my witness is in heaven and my evidence is on high." It's kind of a precursor to what he's saying here. But here, his faith rings out. He basically, this is kind of a change, a sea change for Job in this book. From up to here, his accusations are wild. He's begging for death. He's flailing out. From this point on, as you'll see in just a minute, he begins to be more okay. I know that something's wrong here. I want to go before God. I want God to come and let's talk about this. I know that something's wrong, but it's not the. His mind is way more settled after this. And as in a minute, I'm going to read you the next passage. Well, in fact, let's just do that now. In the sense of going through the book, there are another couple of speeches that come after this. Zophar, in the second round of speeches, Zophar accuses Job of insulting him, which, again, you know, here's poor Job sitting on the ground. Zophar gets mad at him. And then Job, and this is in chapter 20, and then chapter 21, Job again begs for mercy in the sense that, look, I've got these problems. You should notice them. And then he also goes and explains to Zophar how the wicked aren't directly one for one punished. Everybody knows that. There are plenty of wicked people that live good lives. And Job does an excellent job of delineating what a wicked man looks like who God is not punishing at the time. And everybody knows that there are people like that. And so Job makes that point in chapter 21. And then that brings us to chapter 22, which is the one I want to read to you. And the reason I'm picking this one to read to you is because I want you to see the contrast again. Eliphaz began the cycle of speeches by being the most gentle of the three. He just eased into his complaints. Poor Job, he cried out in his anguish, and Eliphaz was slow to go after him and was kind to him for the first couple of sentences in what he said. Now I want you to hear Eliphaz after a couple of rounds here. So, then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, this is Job 22, and this is a long passage, the Eliphaz passage is not long, but the Job one is. Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "Can a man be of benefit to God? Can even a wise man benefit him? What pleasure would it give the Almighty if you were righteous? What would he gain if your ways were blameless? Is it for your piety that he rebukes you and brings charges against you? Is not your wickedness great? Are not your sins endless?" And then here we go. "You demanded security from your brothers for no reason. You stripped men of their clothing, leaving them naked. You gave no water to the weary, and you withheld food from the hungry. though you were a powerful man, owning land, an honorable man, living on it, and you sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. This is why snares are all around you, why sudden peril terrifies you, why it is so dark you cannot see, and why a flood of water covers you. Is not God in the heights of heaven? And see how lofty are the highest stars. Yet you say, what does God know? Does He judge through such darkness? Thick clouds veil Him so He does not see us as He goes about in the vaulted heavens. Will you keep to the old path that evil men have trod? They were carried off before their time, their foundations washed away by a flood. They said to God, leave us alone. What can the Almighty do to us? Yet it was He who filled their houses with good things. So I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. The righteous see their ruin and rejoice. The innocent mock them, saying, surely our foes are destroyed and fire devours their wealth. Submit to God and be at peace with Him. In this way, prosperity will come to you. Accept instruction from His mouth and lay up His words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove wickedness far from your tent and assign your nuggets to the dust, your gold of Ophir to the rocks of the ravines, then the Almighty will be your gold, the choicest silver for you. Surely then you will find delight in the Almighty and will lift up your face to God. You will pray to Him and He will hear you. You will fulfill your vows. What you decide will be done, and light will shine on your ways. When men are brought low and you say, lift them up, then He will save the downcast. He will deliver even one who is not innocent, who will be delivered through the cleanness of your hands. Let's see here. There was one thing I wanted to point out to you. Yes. Verse 30. Oh, absolutely. Well, he's saying that God might restore him if Job would just repent from this series of horrendous sins that he accuses Job. Now remember, he's got no evidence for any of this. There's no reason for him to think this. In fact, I'm going to read you a passage in a minute that shows that not only does he not have evidence for it, he has every evidence against it. And yet he rips into him. And here's the most wise, the most godly, the most orthodox of his three friends standing up and accusing Job for no good reason. He has nothing in his experience, nothing in his background to say that he's done these things. But because of his faulty view of God, his faulty view of retribution, he is forced to either make some change in his view or savage Job. And you see what he chose. So, and then I want to read you Job's response. And this is a fairly long response. And there was another thing I wanted to point out here, and I think I just missed it. Anyway, I'll read Job's response to you in this. Notice that he's talking about God. And notice that there's no more wanting to die in this for him. He's settled down in his thinking somewhat. And now he's being more logical, more rational, more legal, if you will. This is almost like a beginnings of a legal case. In fact, one of the commentators makes the point that the whole book is a legal case and could be viewed as a legal the beginnings of a legal proceeding or some form of legal proceeding where Job is the complainant and God is in the dock and God has to answer Job's request. And that's, we'll see later, that's another reason why Job gets in trouble too. Okay, here we go. This is the response, Job chapter 23:1. Then Job replied, even today my complaint is bitter. His hand is heavy in spite of my groaning. If only I knew where to find him. If only I could go to his dwelling. I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. Would he oppose me with great power? No, he would not press charges against me. There an upright man could present his case before him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. But if I go to the east, he is not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I do not see him. When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. My feet have closely followed his steps. I have kept to his way without turning aside. I have not departed from the commands of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my daily bread. But he stands alone, and who can oppose him? He does whatever he pleases. He carries out his decree against me, and many such plans he still has in store. That is why I am terrified before him. When I think of all this, I fear him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. Yet I am not silenced by the darkness, by the thick darkness that covers my face. Why does the Almighty not set times for judgment? Why must those who know him look in vain for such days? Men move boundary stakes. They pasture flocks they have stolen. They drive away the orphan's donkey and take the widow's oxen pledge. They thrust the needy from the path and force all the poor of the land into hiding. Like wild donkeys in the desert, the poor go about their labor of foraging food. The wasteland provides food for their children. They gather fodder in the fields and glean in the vineyards of the wicked. Lacking clothes, they spend the night naked. They have nothing to cover themselves in the cold. They are drenched by mountain rains and hug the rocks for lack of shelter. The fatherless child is snatched from the breast. The infant of the poor is seized for a debt. Lacking clothes, they go about naked. They carry the sheaves, but still go hungry. They crush olives among the terraces. They tread the winepress, yet suffer thirst. The groans of the dying rise from the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out for help. But God charges no one with wrongdoing. There are those who rebel against the light, who do not know its ways or stay in its paths. When daylight is gone, the murderer rises up and kills the poor and the needy. In the night he steals forth like a thief. The eye of the adulterer watches for dusk. He thinks, no eye will see me, and he keeps his face canceled or concealed. In the dark, men break into houses, but by day they shut themselves in. They want nothing to do with the light. For all of them, deep darkness is their mourning. They make friends with the terrors of darkness. Yet they are foam on the surface of the water. Their portion of the land is cursed so that no one goes to the vineyards. As heat and drought snatch away the melted snow, so the grave snatches away those who have sinned. The womb forgets them. The worm feasts on them. Evil men are no longer remembered, but are broken like a tree. They prey on the barren and the childless woman, and to the widow show no kindness, but God drags away the mighty in his power. Though they become established, they have no assurance of life. He may let them rest in a feeling of security, but his eyes are on their ways. For a little while they are exalted, and then they are gone. They are brought low and gathered up like all others. They are cut off like heads of grain. If this is not so, who can prove me false and reduce my words to nothing? Job shows here that he knows how to describe the wicked. He knows what the wicked are like. He knows what God's dealings with the wicked are like. And they don't apply to him. As much as Eliphaz, as much as Bildad, as much as Zophar try to press on Job that he's one of the wicked, Job has to respond back, I am not. Here, this is what the wicked are like. I understand what they're like as well as you. And in this case, he understands better than they. So, and he shows that he understands better than they with this wonderful passage showing the actual end of the wicked. What are the wicked like and what happens to them? And this passage is beautiful in showing that. Well, the next thing that happens is Bildad comes back and has another little brief. He really has a very short one. And I'm not going to read that because it's just so short and it doesn't really add anything to it. Now, again, I don't want you to get the impression that I'm jumping over these things because they're not worth reading and spending time on. Because when we start going through the book verse by verse, we will spend time on these. And they are well worth reading. And there's many applications that we'll be able to use for our own lives. But for just the purposes of an introduction, I want to skip over that and get to some of the other things. I was hoping, and I may be able to do it, to be able to close out with Job. I think the last few things we're going to read today are some fairly lengthy passages about Job. That, we're going to begin to see more. Here in this last passage I read you, we begin to see that Job really does understand God and understands the wicked. Has a close relationship with the Lord. And now we're gonna see even more when we hear the last couple of chapters, 26 and 27 are Job's response to Bildad. I mean, really, they're kind of his response to all three of them. And let me read this to you, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. Then Job replied, "How you have helped the powerless, how you have saved the arm that is feeble." And he's obviously talking about himself here. And "what advice you have offered to one without wisdom, and what great insight you have displayed. Who has helped you utter these words, and whose spirit spoke from your mouth?" And you know, I do want to point out here, again, Job, he goes too far with these guys. They were wrong in what they did, but he also is angry with them, and understandably angry with them. And so what, you know, in the end, what does God have to do? God has to humble Job and make him offer sacrifice for these guys and make him pray for these guys. And he had to humble these guys and make them go to Job. So, you know, they're squabbling here. And even though it's flowery language and pretty, but still, he went just a little bit too far. Who has helped? Let's see. The dead are in deep anguish, those beneath the waters and all that live in them. Death is naked before God. Destruction lies uncovered. He spreads out the northern skies over empty space. He suspends the earth over nothing. He wraps up the waters in his clouds, yet the clouds do not burst under their weight. Amazing. He covers the face of the full moon, spreading his clouds over it. He marks out the horizon on the face of the waters for a boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of the heavens quake, aghast at his rebuke. By his power he churned up the sea. By his wisdom he cut Rahab into pieces. And I think Rahab there means Egypt. But at any rate. By his breath the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. And these, all these things he just named, these are but the outer fringe of his works. How faint the whisper we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of his power? And Job continued in his discourse, "As surely as God lives, who has denied me justice, the Almighty who has made me taste the bitterness of soul, as long as I have life within me, the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, and my tongue will utter no deceit. I will never admit that you are in the right till I die. I will not deny my integrity. I will maintain my righteousness and never let go of it. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. May my enemies be like the wicked, my adversaries like the unjust. For what hope has the godless man when he is cut off, when God takes away his life? Does God listen to his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he find delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? I will teach you about the power of God. The ways of the Almighty I will not conceal. You have all seen this yourselves. Why then this meaningless talk? Here is the fate God allots to the wicked, the heritage. The heritage a ruthless man receives from the Almighty. However many his children, their fate is the sword. His offspring will never have enough to eat. The plague will bury those who survive him, and their widows will not weep for them. Though he heaps up silver like dust and clothes like piles of clay, what he lays up the righteous will wear, and the innocent will divide his silver. The house he builds is like a moss cocoon, like a hut made by a watchman. He lies down wealthy, but will do so no more. When he opens his eyes, all is gone. Terror overtakes him like a flood. A tempest snatches him away in the night. The east wind carries him off, and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls himself against him without mercy as he flees headlong from its power. It claps its hands in derision and hisses him out of his place." So Job is responding now to his critics. You can see by this that his understanding of God is equally, in other words, in his eyes, God is equally omnipotent. He's equally able to deal with the righteous and the wicked, and he deals equally with them, but not exactly one for one in this life. In other words, you cannot look at the outward state of a man and decide that this man is godly or not godly by the outward circumstances of his life. You can see a man who's sitting on the ground in a heap of ashes with his clothes torn with an incurable disease, and that man can be the godliest man in the age. You can see men who are wealthy and wise and kind and generous and to all outward appearances, great godly men, and they can have significant problems in their thinking and even be unbelievers. Now, I'm not saying that these men were unbelievers, because I think they probably were, but looking at the two, the outward circumstances of the two, you're tempted. We're all tempted. And as we go through this passage in detail, I'll have a lot to say about that. We're all tempted to look at the outward circumstances of a man. And here Job is saying, no, it's not, you can't do that. The next thing I want to read to you, I'm just going to kind of keep going in this, the next three or four chapters. In the next passage of Scripture, chapter 28, it's a beautiful, beautiful description of wisdom. What is wisdom? Here these guys now have been back and forth arguing about man's state before God in relationship to his outward state. Okay? And his friends have got the wrong view. We talked about that at length. And so Job goes into this long statement here about what wisdom is. Where does it come from? How do people become wise? And what does it look like? So here we go. I'm going to read this passage. First off, he's going to talk about mining practices. And these are Persian mining practices. And it's the best description of Persian mining practices there is, the extant. So he was a smart guy. He was able to know a lot of things here. And we'll see some of the beauty of it, certainly when I go into detail, because some of the words he chooses here are just wonderful. There is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to darkness in the mine, here is what he's saying. He searches the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft in places forgotten by the foot of man. And far from men, he dangles and sways. The earth from which food comes is transformed below as by fire. Sapphires come from its rock, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rock. His eyes see all its treasures. He searches the source of the rivers and brings hidden things to light. Now, I'm going to stop right here for a second. I think he's actually talking about a category of things that men are capable of doing on the earth. And I think of them as like engineering things. Men, because they have been given the mandate to subdue the earth and rule it, have the ability to subdue the earth and rule it. God gave them the ability to do it. So, something that, who knew how you would even start to think about digging a shaft for a mine? But men do it, and they're good at it, and they come up with their ability to do it, they come up with the resources to do it, the technology to do it, the tools to do it, and they're able to do that kind of thing. But that's not wisdom. That is engineering. Is not wisdom. And so now we go to the next passage. Let's see here. Where was I? Here we go, starting at 12. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, the precious onyx or sapphires. Neither gold or crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention. The price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Cush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and He alone knows where it dwells. And this has significance for us. This is very important. For He views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When He established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when He made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, Then he looked at wisdom and appraised it, and he confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. Where does wisdom come from? It does not come from the unaided reason of man. And we're going to see in a little bit, there's another description of there are descriptions of animals who don't have wisdom, or have wisdom taken away from them, or not created in them. And the point being that man does not have the capability of reasoning his way to God. He just doesn't. It's not created in him. He will never be able to do it. The only way to get to God and to understand wisdom is to it has to be revealed to you from God. And this is the major theme of this book, is that everything, think of Job, it hasn't been revealed to him what God's doing to him yet. It hasn't been revealed, so he doesn't know. It hasn't been revealed to Eliphaz what God's doing, so he doesn't know. It has to be revealed. It has been revealed to us, because it was real, or we wouldn't know. If we read this without reading the first chapter, we wouldn't know. We have no way, as created beings, to reason our way to wisdom. It has to be revealed to us. And that has tremendous implications, and again, we'll spend a lot of time on this when we get to this passage of Scripture. Next, I want to talk, I'm going to read you, we're going to get into kind of a fuller understanding of just how Job lived his life. He was a godly man. We've said that all along. God said it at the very beginning, but now we begin to have evidence of it. He's going to show kind of what his life was like, how he lived. Starting in 29, Job continued his discourse. How I long for the months gone by, for the days when God watched over me, when His lamp shone upon my head, and by His light I walked through darkness. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime, when God's intimate friendship blessed my house, when the Almighty was still with me and my children were around me, when my path was drenched with cream and the rock poured out for me streams of olive oil. When I went to the gate of the city and took my seat in the public square, the young men saw me and stepped aside, and the old men rose to their feet. The chief men refrained from speaking and covered their mouths with their hands. The voices of the nobles were hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roofs of their mouths. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to assist him. The man who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was father to the needy. I took up the cause of the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched the victims from their teeth. I thought, I will die in my own house. My days as numerous as the grains of sand. My roots will reach to the water, and the dew will lie all night on my branches. My glory will remain fresh in me, the bough ever new in my hand. Men listened to me expectantly, waiting in silence for my counsel. After I had spoken, they spoke no more. My words fell gently on their ears. They waited for me as for showers and drank in my words as the spring rain. When I smiled at them, they scarcely believed it. The light of my face was precious to them. I chose the way for them and sat as their chief. I dwelt as a king among his troops. I was like one who comforts mourners. And then he now goes into a description of what it's like for him now. What's happening to him right now? And you can see the contrast. But now they mock me, men younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. Of what use was the strength of their hands to me, since their vigor had gone from them? Haggard from want and hunger, they roamed the parched land and desolate wastelands at night. In the brush they gathered salted herbs, and their food was the root of the broom tree. They were banished from their fellow men, shouted at as if they were thieves. They were forced to live in the dry stream beds among the rocks and in holes in the ground. They brayed among the bushes and huddled in the undergrowth. A base and nameless brood, they were driven out of the land. And now their sons mock me in song. I have become a byword among them. They detest me and keep their distance. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. Now that God has unstrung my bow and afflicted me, they throw off restraint in my presence. On my right, the tribe attacks. They lay snares for my feet. They build their siege ramps against me. They break up my road. They succeed in destroying me without anyone's helping them. They advance as through a gaping breach. Amid the ruins they come rolling in. Terrors overwhelm me. My dignity is driven away as by the wind. My safety vanishes like a cloud. And now my life ebbs away. Days of suffering grip me. Night pierces my bones. My gnawing pains never rest. In His great power, God becomes like clothing to me. He binds me like the neck of my garment. He throws me into the mud and I am reduced to dust and ashes. I cry out to You, O God, but You do not answer. I stand up, but You merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of Your hand, You attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. I know You will bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all living. Surely no one lays a hand on a broken man when he cries for help in his distress. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Yet when I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, then came darkness. The churning inside me never stops. Days of suffering confront me. I go about blackened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I have become a brother of jackals and a companion of owls. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My harp is turned to mourning and my flute to the sound of wailing. I want to go, we're going to have to go very quickly now to the next passage because I want to complete this. I want you to have a complete feel for what a godly man Job was. In this next passage, it goes through a series of things, discussions, I guess, of how Job lived his life and things that he did, vows that he took. And when we get to this passage, I'm going to challenge you to take some of these vows. They're difficult vows, and maybe we should consider taking some of them ourselves, certainly some of the men. So here we go, chapter 31. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. For what is man's lot from God above, his heritage from the Almighty on high? Is it not ruin for the wicked, disasters for those who do wrong? Does he not see my ways and count my every step? If I have walked in falsehood or my foot has hurried after deceit, let God weigh me in honest scales and He will know that I am blameless. If my steps have turned from the path, if my heart has been led by my eyes, or if my hands have been defiled, then may others eat what I have sown and may my crops be uprooted. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then may my wife grind another man's grain and may other men sleep with her. For that would have been shameful, a sin to be judged. It is a fire that burns to destruction. It would have uprooted my harvest. If I have denied justice to my men servants and my maid servants when they had a grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when called to account? Did not He who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same One form us both within our mothers? If I have denied the desires of the poor or let the eyes of the widow grow weary, if I have kept my bread to myself, not sharing it with the fatherless, but from my youth I reared him as would a father, and from my birth I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perishing for the lack of clothing, or a needy man without a garment, and his heart did not bless me for warming him with the fleece from my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, knowing that I had influence in court, then let my arm fall from the shoulder, let it be broken off at the joint. For I dreaded destruction from God, and for fear of His splendor, I could not do such things. If I have put my trust in gold, or said to pure gold, You are my security. If I have rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands had gained. If I have regarded the sun in its radiance, or the moon moving in splendor, so that my heart was secretly enticed, and my hand offered them a kiss of homage. Then those also would be sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high. If I have rejoiced at my enemy's misfortunes or gloated over the trouble that came to him, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by invoking a curse against his life. If the men of my household have never said, Who has not had his fill of Job's meat? But no stranger had to spend the night in the street, for my door was always open to the traveler. If I have concealed my sin as men do by hiding my guilt in my heart, because I so feared the crowd and so dreaded the contempt of the clans that I kept silent and would not go outside, oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. I would give him an account of my every step. Like a prince I would approach him. If my land cries out against me, and all its furrows are wet with tears, if I have devoured its yield without payment or broken the spirit of its tenants, then let briars come up instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. This is the end of Job's defense of his righteousness. And I consider it to be a very strong one. Here is a man who lived a godly life. And in every area of his life, he was doing all the things that the Scripture requires of us. He was evidencing a godly life in every possible area. And then when we start through this, it's humiliating to, or has been to me, to read, humbling to me, to read this and read what Job did and what a life he lived and what's required of us. So next week we're going to look at the speeches of Elihu and maybe the speeches of the Lord. I don't know if I'll get through past the speeches of Elihu next week or not. And then we'll be done with the introductory part. Thanks. That's it. Time's up.